Do you like to be the first? Name of your sex tape? Well, if you like to be the first to listen to podcasts, you might want to check out our Patreon, because now we're offering a brand new membership tier called Name of Your Sex Tape. I couldn't help it, guys. I'm sorry. For £5 a month, you'll get an ad-free version of our weekly episode on a Tuesday, a full day earlier than its usual release. So you can be the very first to talk about how funny our guest was, how quickly you cracked the case, or how badly I answered a question. Plus, you'll get all the benefits of our regular tier, including our live Zoom records, a special shout out on the podcast, and if you really like to hear us talk, we've got an entire back catalog of extra content. Check it out on patreon.com/drunkwomensolvingcrime.
Name of your sex tape. Name of your sex tape.
Name of your sex tape.
Fancy coming along to see Drunk Women Solving Crime live?
Ooh, yes, please.
Why not join us for our monthly London residency at the marvellous Museum of Comedy? We've got monthly shows through to June.
Plus, every show is a double header, so you get to see us record not one, but two episodes with two fantastic guests.
You can find tickets on our website, drunkwomensolvingcrime.com.
Shows are selling out fast, so be quick.
Noice.
Noice.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Guys, huge news. We are finally going live again every single month. We're doing a London residency.
Yes!
Genuinely.
And it's at the Museum of Comedy.
You can come and see one show, or you can stay for the double header. Our first show is on the 20th of July, and then 31st of August, 28th of September, 26th of October. Those are all Tuesdays. It's Tipsy Tuesday. Tickets can be purchased from drunkwomensolvingcrime.com.
Drunk Women Solving.
Is Drunk Women Solving Crime. My name's Katie Wilkins and I'm an author and comedian. I'm joined by screenwriter Hannah George.
Hello.
And writer-comedian Taylor Glenn.
Hello.
This is where brandy meets bludgeoning, mimosa meets misdemeanor, and port meets prostitution. It's a true crime podcast with a twist of lime. Coming up on Drunk Women Solving Crime.
Latest semen.
Yes, no one's got anything funny.
Wow, okay. Well, I've got a lot to live up to in this story.
God, it was a simpler time.
I just am super distrusting of anybody from previous time periods because they're just mostly terrible.
Welcome to another episode of Drunk Women Solving Crime. This week, we are joined by the fantastic actress, entertainment reporter, and TV host, it's Heather Brooker!
Yay!
Welcome! So happy to be here, ladies. I'm so excited.
Welcome,
we're excited to have you. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Yeah, we've got like live satellite link up. We've got everything going on. Heather, we have one question on this podcast. Have you ever been the victim of a crime?
I believe that I have. My husband has had his truck robbed, like, you know, stuff stolen out of his truck. But me personally, I have not been the victim of any like crime in the traditional sense. I've been more of a victim of sort of a crime against my person and my body in terms of like how I get treated sometimes online and the comments that people make to me. You know, I'm a plus size gal in an industry that doesn't really hold value for women who are over a size two or four or, you know, so I often get made fun of online. Some people make rude comments. I think also behind closed doors, I don't get as many opportunities as some of my more thin counterparts. And so to me, that's a crime. I don't know if that counts in your book, but that to me is a crime. Because
agreed.
I don't think that my size or my body size has any bearing on whether or not I can tell a good story and be entertaining. Yeah. And that's sort of what my industry is all about. So that's what I'm going to go with.
Yeah.
Well, that genuinely, doesn't it follow under discrimination?
I was going to say, that has a name and everything, that crime.
It's got a name and everything.
It does, but it's hard to prove because no one is ever going to outright go, we're not going to hire you because you're fat, or we're not going to give you this opportunity because you're overweight or whatever. No one's going to do that. They're not going to outright do that. Yeah. You just get, oh, we don't have the budget right now. Or, you know, we have different casting in mind. You know, you get all kinds of different excuses, but you, after a while, you kind of start to read through the lines. Like, I've been a reporter for 20 plus years. Oh, wow. Not to like tell you how old I am. I mean, I started when I was 12. But I've been doing this a very long time. And so you kind of start to pick up on what's really going down, what's really happening. And my thing is, my whole thing is, I just keep pressing on. I'm grateful for the people who do give me opportunities and who do want to cast me in their show or hire me to be a TV host and that sort of thing. I'm so grateful for that. But, and I try not to dwell on what I don't have. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense.
Because the other thing we always ask people is, what would you say to the perp or perpetrators? Like, if, like, cards on the table, it's been proved that they are operating bias, definitely. What would you say?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, kind of like what I just said is that my size and my physicality doesn't have a bearing on my ability to tell a good story. You know, so often people are overlooked. Obviously, I mean, we know discrimination is a huge problem all over the world, and especially here in the United States, but all over the world. And I think that it also applies to body size. Something that I hope to encourage women and hope to encourage employers, people in casting, people in Hollywood, to start giving women, especially women, a chance. It doesn't seem to affect men the same way. There was an intern at my TV station where I work several years ago who was doing her thesis, her college thesis on plus size reporters and how there literally aren't any. There's like, if you notice in your local newscast, there's probably not anybody who's overweight, right? They all sort of look the same. They all have generally the same haircut. Nobody's really like plus size. And that's a huge problem because that's a huge portion of the population that isn't being represented in the news and in TV hosting and that sort of thing. And so she did her whole thesis on me and compared to, there's a several plus size male reporters who say no one ever comments on their size. No one ever tells them to lose weight. No one ever tells them that the clothes they wear don't look good or look too tight or whatever. And that happens to me a lot. A lot. Yeah. Like there's, anytime I go live, like on our social media or anything like that, someone will, gosh, there's this one troll that always will say fat lives matter every single time without
fail. Same person or just a
same person every time. But then there's other people that sort of piggyback on that. Like someone actually called me Miss Piggy, you know, and I was like literally doing a fun story about, you know, Disney. And I was like, is that really necessary? Yeah. So it happens a lot. Like, and those are the kinds of crimes that I think get dismissed a lot because nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody wants to speak up about it. It's not a sexy crime. You know what I mean? Like, it's not a murdery, bloody crime, but it certainly is a crime against humanity and women in particular. And it can really be disheartening. It can really eat at your soul if you're not strong enough to handle those types of comments and stuff like that.
You shouldn't have to be strong. You shouldn't have to develop like a thick skin just to do your job. I mean, it's absolutely outrageous. Right.
Exactly. I remember when we first started this podcast, knowing that it's all going to be women. We're going to be talking about sort of, you know, feminism and women's things and
women's things. Lady stuff.
And, you know, it is that thing of, you know, you kind of pause. Like at the very beginning, I didn't even want to be in the podcast. And as we know, I'm like probably the most popular one. So no, I'm joking. But you know,
we wouldn't even be here.
But like we definitely stopped and we talked about the idea of sort of, you know, doing a podcast and that we'd probably get trolled just for being women as well, which is kind of crazy. And then as the podcast has got bigger and bigger, the sort of the risk gets higher and higher. But actually the amount of sort of like brilliant fans we have kind of really outweighs the occasional person.
Yeah.
The trolls. Yeah.
I just found it so interesting you talking about reporters in the US. I've been in the UK for a long time, like 16 years. But I remember one of the first things that blew my mind is just looking at how different news reporters are here. Like you turn on the BBC and I was like, oh, the women, it's almost like they haven't been hired because of their looks. This is very strange. Mm-hmm. And now it's so weird when I go back and all of the women are just so done up. And it's almost like the more right wing they are, the more they're done up to, like the Fox News women there.
But it's very prevalent here in Hollywood too. I mean, you know, you've got a certain aesthetic that's expected as a Hollywood reporter or even just being in LA.
Yeah.
I mean, that's applied honestly to every news market. You look at Dallas, you look at, you know, your big news markets, New York, there's a certain way that women are supposed to carry themselves. Like, I used to joke around with my friends when I was graduating journalism school. There's a bunch of us girls who were all looking for reporter jobs. We were hungry. Mm-hmm. We were ready to go out and tell stories. And we all were like, oh, I guess we got to go get the anchor haircut, which was basically like, we all had to get the same haircut, like short cut cropped, because you can't have long hair because the wind will blow it around. And when you're out live, that will draw away from your seriousness. And you had to have a certain cadence to your voice, which I'm sure you guys have noticed before with newscasters. And so it's this sort of cookie cutter idea when it comes to newscasters that you can easily be put in any news situation in any market in the country and still tell a story and not be like offensive to look at for someone if you're new to the market, where they won't be like, oh, this woman is huge. Like, how can she talk about these stories? You know what I mean? Like, you don't want to be distracting with your double chin, you know?
No, but it's just...
But that's a real thing that happens and nobody talks about it because most newsrooms in this country are run by men. Most general managers at the television stations here are men, and they have been for many, many years. They have a certain aesthetic that they want their lady newscasters to have.
It's mad. Like thinking about news here. 34 years, like the news in this country was always male. It was always sort of that clipped English of today. We are like every single thing sounded as though you were going to war because that was the voice that everybody was doing. There was a cat up a tree and, you know, and it was so serious. And now, you know, things have changed, but actually there's not a huge, you know, there's not as much diversity in the news over here as, but you're right. Everybody doesn't look like Fox News. And watching the election, it was interesting watching like American newscasters.
But it's crazy.
Yeah.
We could slag off the systematic problems all day because they are many. Just going back to Twitter and trolls and stuff, it's just, it is that thing as well as like when a woman sticks her head above the parapet and trolls go for her, they're sending a message to other women, stay in your box. So like the best thing we can do is just keep out of our boxes and just keep jumping up and down so they can all see our heads.
Yes, absolutely.
So, yeah, don't change a thing.
Now it's time for Drunk Women Solving Crime.
So we are now going to move on to the true crime section of the podcast. And I'm going to start telling you this story at the point where a woman admits herself into a boarding house. And this boarding house is called Temporary Homes for Females. Now, during the night, she starts to appear disturbed and she begins making accusations that the other boarders were insane. She's quoted as telling the assistant matron, "There are so many crazy people about and one can never tell what they will do." She then refused to go to bed and eventually scared so many of the other boarders that the police were called to take her to a nearby courthouse. So my first question is, what year do you think this is?
It sounds like my first year in college. So. Boarding house, a woman making accusation.
I mean, maybe 1920s or 30s.
Okay, we've got 1920s or 30s from Heather.
I might go a bit earlier than that. Like boarding house, it feels quite Victorian to me. I'm seeing Victorian London. I'm seeing 1887. I'll go with that.
Okay, Hannah George. This is the Price is Right moment. Taylor,
it is the Price is Right. The first year that popped into my head was 1829.
Okay. I can now tell you, and this almost never happens, but Hannah George is spot on. It is 1887.
No way! That's I told you I was the best one.
That's amazing.
This is like a lunar eclipse. This is incredible.
I'm kind of freaked out because you didn't say, I'm thinking you said, I see. And now I'm like... Are you really seeing things? We've been doing this too long, is what I'm suggesting.
Wow. Okay. Well, I've got a lot to live up to in this story. What's next, Jenny?
Yes, it's only you can't be wrong now, Hannah. We have no pressure on us, but you.
So the year is 1887. The woman is taken to the courthouse. At the courthouse, she is examined by a police officer, a judge, and a doctor who are to determine the state of her mental health. Mm. Sort of two questions, really. What do they conclude and what do they decide to do with her?
Hysteria.
Okay.
And I don't want to answer the second part.
Okay.
I mean, I would say maybe they think she's seen ghosts. Okay. And maybe they tell her to get some rest.
Yeah. I love it. Any advance, Hannah George?
Yeah, no, that's a good one. I think, yeah, because it's 1887. Whatever she's not going to have many rights, is she? So it sort of depends if she has a husband, as it often does in these cases, okay. Doesn't it? Like, so if she has a husband, it might be go home to your husband. And he'll deal with you. Or if she doesn't, go home to your father. It's going to involve going to a man.
Okay. If she's been in this boarding house, then I don't think she has a support.
Yeah, she's in a kind of a female's only.
That would be my, yeah.
I'm losing my lead here. Okay. Panic. they probably put her in jail, don't they?
Pretty close. So she is declared insane. A probable lost cause, and she is sent to the asylum on Blackwell's Island, which is now called Roosevelt Island.
Oh, wow.
Hmm. That's intense. Yeah.
Yes. That's pretty decisive, isn't it?
So at this time in history, lots of women were taken to insane asylums for varying reasons, which we'll get into in a bit. So my next question is, what is unusual about this particular woman?
Just based on what you've told us so far. Yeah.
So she's been declared insane. Lots of women get taken to asylum. She's been taken to this particular asylum. But what is unusual about this particular woman in this instance?
Is she maybe like, I'm obsessed with linking this to a man, but if she may be the daughter of a prominent family or something. So
thinking too initially, maybe she's connected somehow to someone who wants to get rid of her, like somebody prominent in the community that's like, she got quickly dismissed because she had an affair with someone.
Okay, nice. I love it. Mm. Anything different, Taylor?
I don't know why this popped into my head, but I wondered if maybe she had a disability of some sort.
Okay.
But I don't know. That doesn't feel like the question you ask.
But that's interesting, like what Heather said about it being, well, basically the thing at the beginning about the fact that she came in going like everybody else is kind of crazy, which I suppose could be a thing that you come in. But if perhaps she, like we were saying, she's had an affair or something and she's done something else and people are saying, oh no, she's definitely, she's the problem. Well, maybe she's being silenced and sent to Roosevelt Island.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know what? I love everybody's answers. None of you have got it correct.
Katie really makes us feel good along the way. That's her superpower.
But you guys had such interest. Like, that was really interesting. The thing that makes this particular woman different from the other women being sent to insane asylums at this time, she is faking it. She is not really insane. She's an investigative journalist.
Oh.
Oh, snap.
Does she have the proper haircut?
That's juicy. Yeah. She was like 21 Jump Street before 21 Jump Street. So she was like posing to get into the insane asylum.
Yeah, hold that thought, because she is basically the original and inventor of investigative journalism.
Wow.
So in fact, you guys might, once I tell you her name, you guys will probably know her.
This is really ringing a bell.
So her name is Nellie Bly. That's her pen name. Her real name was Elizabeth Cochran, later Seaman. Yes, no one's got anything funny. That's
good. I'm like such a child. I'm like, they said Seaman. I'll go there.
I love that. Like, it's taken women so long to get taken seriously in journalism anyway. And then you go in with the name Seaman.
And it was right, like the founder of investigative journalism was a Seaman.
I love that she changed it to Nellie Seaman. What was it? Lenny Bly.
Yeah.
Well, no, yeah. So Nellie Bly, she ran with Nellie Bly. That was her pen name. So she is pretending to be Nellie Brown, in fact, to get into the asylum. so that she can write about what it's really like inside. Now, she is writing for Joseph Pulitzer's newspaper, The New York World, and she is the first person to really do this. So she sort of invents exposés, and she was worried that she wouldn't be able to behave, you know, credibly insane to be able to trick everyone. But then she discovered it was super easy because, like, everyone is terrified of insane people, and it's actually much, much harder to present as sane once everyone is convinced that you are insane. And so what she did was she stayed up all night to give herself this wide-eyed look of a disturbed woman. And she
like any parent, basically.
Yeah.
One night, staying up one night. Like, come on, Nelly.
Well, I mean, yeah. She apparently told herself ghost stories to scare herself into staying awake.
Ah, I knew there was a ghost connection in there somewhere.
There we go.
I love the idea of telling yourself ghost stories. And then at the window, there was a ghost.
Oh no, what's going to happen? I know, but
God, it was a simpler time.
Mm-hmm. So question, what did Nellie Bly think she would discover about asylums before she went in? What did she think?
I'm assuming if she's used to writing exposés, she knows that the conditions are going to be very poor.
Okay.
And she's ready for whatever that means. She's ready to document that. Is that what you mean? Like what she expected?
Yeah, yeah. So you think she's expecting the worst, probably.
And was surprised by how much worse it even was. But yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I think at the time, like there was so little sort of research into mental health at that time as well. So, but you've got to think about it for that time, I suppose. For 1887, maybe they're being quite progressive there. And maybe, you know, because you look at some stories of asylums and you just think, wow, that what they did to people was tantamount to torture.
Mm.
But so if it's not torture, then maybe she's like, but I think she's expecting to find something bad. I would say.
Okay.
Yeah, I would think that she's expected to find some like abuse going on or, you know, some like the women are being abused or maybe they're not being fed or, you know, something like that.
Tested on perhaps as well.
Yeah. Okay. We're also all kind of in agreement. There'll be some darkness. Now, she actually thought that they would be mainly nice. This is what she said. She said that she'd always wanted to learn about these places to know for sure that the most helpless of God's creatures were truly being taken care of. But she also said that she had heard some stories of abuse and mistreatment, but she dismissed them as exaggerated or else romances imagined by gossipy public. So there's enough that she thinks there's a story and it's worth checking out. But it looked like she was maybe going in for more of a heartwarming story or something from the outs.
To be like, look how nice these ladies in the asylum have it. They get they're just sitting around luxuriating, you know, and talking in women's circles and things like that.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. So I think maybe that was what she thought the anger would be. And as you guys have already said, that is not what she discovers. It is, of course, a heartbreaking tale of woe and cruelty. Mm. So Nellie spends one night in the Bellevue Hospital before she's transferred to Blackwell Island, now Roosevelt Island. I don't know which one I should. Shall I just call it Roosevelt Island?
Sure.
The first person Nellie meets is a poor chambermaid called Anne Neville. And Anne got sick, so she was being treated in a sister's home. But then her nephew lost his job and he couldn't afford to pay for her illness anymore. So she had to be transferred to Bellevue, which was a charity. So she was completely sane, but there wasn't any money or anything for her in an actual hospital. But once she's in this insane place, like the doctors keep trying to confuse her so they can officially diagnose her as insane and stuff. Nearly all the women that she meets are not wealthy or, you know, they're from immigrant families and life in New York had left them with very few options outside of the asylum. And I think one of my sources said that it was a snake eating its own tail type of situation because these women were sent to an asylum regardless of the context or reasons. And then, of course, they were assumed insane. So then, you know, the questions were just used to confirm that they were insane that rather than anyone. So it's just bias in action.
And then you've got this woman coming in telling everyone ghost stories and she's making it worse.
Yeah, make it a really shit story. That whole thing. In particular, there was this one young woman called Tilly Maynard, and she had recently recovered from a fever, but she was still suffering a nervous debility. And her friends had sent us to Bellevue, had sent her, did I say us?
Uh-oh. Oh,
God.
Yes, you did. Sent us to Bellevue.
Honestly, I'm so ill. Her friends had sent her to Bellevue. And on learning that she'd been locked away, she's, you know, goes to the doctor and says that she's sane. You know, she says to him, if you know anything at all, you should be able to tell that I am perfectly sane. Why don't you test me? And the doctor said, we know all we want to on that score. So they really were not interested in helping
Wow.
These women. So And most of these women, poor and female, which are the two very powerless sections of society. And there was also a stigma because that and then insanity and all of this. So
also, it's like so hard as well, isn't it? It's sort of like that thing, the first time you say to your partner, I'm not mad. Like, I'm not mad at you. It's like you can't like convince him that you're not. So it's like, it just gets worse the more you say it. I'm not. I swear it's fine.
And then you start getting more and more mad. No, I'm not mad.
Listening. Yeah. And then after an hour, okay, I'm mad now. Great.
Now I am mad.
Now I'm mad.
What have you done?
So once she's been transferred to the island, Nellie stops acting insane and she just acts as her normal self because she was only trying to be crazy to get in. And she says the more sanely she talked, the crazier she was thought to be.
Wow.
So, question.
It's like when you pretend to be drunk when you're acting, you should just try to be as sober as possible. It's exactly the same. Yes.
You can walk in a straight line and everything. Drunk women solving crime.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Question, what do we think the food was like?
Okay.
Probably a standard 3-course, 2 protein.
Yeah,
I'm not sure
nutritious.
How the foie gras was in the late 1800s.
Maybe just like fish. Are they on an island?
Yeah.
So maybe all they eat is
that
fish.
That is a great guess, actually. Yeah.
I imagine there wasn't a lot of food, perhaps. Not plentiful, is what I would say.
Yeah, okay. All excellent. Nellie described the food as barely edible. It was slightly spoiled and cold meat, thin and flavourless broth and tea, and bread that was black and dirty and hard, in places nothing more than dried dough, and which she found a spider in.
Wow.
And she can't make herself eat it, but the other residents are hungry enough that they nearly leap over each other to reach as much food as they can, and so they eat her bread without complaint.
Do you know what? I bit into an apple the other day and I swear there was like a slug in it or something. It was like, it was so disgusting. But I bit into it and half of it had already gone into my mouth.
Oh, no.
And then I like put the apple in some Tupperware in my fridge and kept it just in case I died and they wanted to see what happened. And I was like, Toby, it's in the fridge. It's in the fridge if I like start hallucinating. So I was like, that could have been anything. Turns out I think it was just a bit moldy, but...
Wow.
What I'm saying is we've all been there.
Glad you survived.
Yes, thank you.
It's like that joke, what's worse than biting into an apple and finding
a worm?
Finding half a
nothing.
Worm. Is that the joke?
Yeah, that is the joke.
Yeah,
I can remember jokes. That happening to you because we were chatting about something and you gave me the play-by-play and it was just the best thing that you saved it in case you died.
Your worm eating?
The psychedelic slug is still in the fridge. Okay, also, not only was the food terrible, the nurses were terrible. They would taunt the inmates. They were pretty brutal, abusing them. There are several stories, you know, where a woman would be choked or given a black eye or has her hair pulled for no reason whatsoever by the nurses. When she arrives, Nellie's given a freezing cold bath. When she's still wet, she's sort of put back to bed so that everything just gets wet. Like her hair's still wet, so she's always freezing. There's a quote where she says, "Nearly all night long, I listen to a woman cry about the cold and beg for God to let her die. Another one yelled murder at frequent intervals and police at others until my flesh felt creepy." So if anyone ever asks for more blankets or clothes, they're told they can't have them. And the nurses would say things like, this is a charity, you should be thankful for what you get and shouldn't complain.
Oh my God.
Poor Heather, this is midday for Heather because we're all in the UK and we're like 8 o'clock having a beer, like, okay. Heather's barely starting her work day.
So this is bleak.
Well, thanks so much for having me on, guys. This has been super uplifting. Yes. No, I mean, I knew there was going to be some crime and some darkness. I'm actually just glad that it's not like a bloody, bludgeoning, like rapey situation. Cause I was like, I don't want to talk about that, but this is actually like interesting.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I think this is fascinating. I love this
cool.
stuff.
Okay, cool. Cause there's a bit more of the bleak stuff before we get to the, some more.
Bring it on. I've got my wine. So I'm good, you guys.
So that like the day of the inmates, they'd get up, they'd do all the cleaning and upkeep of the institution, clean the nurses' bedrooms and everything. And then they would have to just sit on a bench for no reason for several hours. They'd have to sit up straight. And if they slouched or anything, they'd be told off. And Nellie Bly writes about this, that this causes the insanity that they supposedly treat. So in this quote, she says, I was never so tired as I grew sitting on those benches. Several of the patients would sit on one foot or sideways to make a change, but they were always reproved and told to sit up straight. If they talked, they were scolded and told to shut up. If they wanted to walk around in order to take the stiffness out of them, they were told to sit down and be still. What accepting torture would produce insanity quicker than this treatment? I would like the expert physicians who are condemning me for my action to take a perfectly sane and healthy woman, shut her up and make her sit from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. on straight back benches. Do not allow her to talk or move during those hours. Give her no reading and let her know nothing of the world or its doings. Give her bad food and harsh treatment and see how long it will take to make her insane. 2 months would make her a mental and physical wreck. So my next question is, how long was Nellie Bly in this asylum for?
Ooh, interesting.
Just under 2 months.
Yeah, I mean, I would say probably if she got out before she herself actually went crazy, which it sounds like maybe she did enough to at least write about the treatment, I would say maybe a month. Okay. I would say maybe a month.
Because also it depends, like these days, I guess a sort of investigative journalist, they can go undercover for quite a while, depending on what they're doing. But because she was kind of inventing it at this time, she could be like, okay, day two, I'm out. I've invented investigative journalism and it's mine.
Yeah.
So I imagine, to be honest, she wouldn't have stayed that long just because it sounds awful. So I'm going to go like 4 days. That's about as long as I can spend at Center Parcs. So,
but then you have to wonder like how, if they were so, how she got out, like if it was easy for her to get out, like, I would think maybe it would take some time of her convincing them. No, I'm actually not crazy. I'm a journalist. And then contacting someone on the outside to vouch for her. Like, I would imagine that that was a process that maybe took a while, but I don't know. We don't know if she told somebody that she was going in, like, hey, extract me in 4 days or extract me in a month or whatever. You know what I mean?
So, I hope so. Okay.
Okay.
That's where my head went. I'm like, she wanted to stay for a week, but it turned into 6 months.
Right.
Yeah. It's like when you get a mate to call you when you're on a date and you're kind of like, just call me at 6 o'clock as a get out. That's what she needed. And I'm glad she did it. She'd been on enough dates to know you need that mate calling you with an emergency.
Yes. An exit plan.
I was thinking around a month. So I'll say a little bit more. I'll say 6 weeks.
Okay. In that case, I got to give it to Hannah George. She stayed in there for 10 days.
Okay. Which would be a lifetime, let's face it.
It must have felt like a lifetime.
Yeah.
And after 10 days, the newspaper went and got her out again. And that was the plan.
Oh, good. Because that's what I was wondering. I was like, did she tell somebody that she was going in there? Otherwise, was she going rogue, you know, inventing this new journalism? And like, because no one probably would have believed her if she was like, no, I'm actually a journalist. And they would have been like, whatever, lady with your lady parts.
When they do it in films and they do it like for people that are actual FBI agents and stuff, and they've managed to convince other people that they're mad, and they're kind of like, no, I'm an FBI agent. And like, and so the more, like established you are, the worse it is to try and convince people that you're not mad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whoa, real catch 22.
I'm always thinking about like, how would we take this to screen? So I've added like a sinister rival journalist who is the person that's supposed to come pick her up, but then she's like, I've never seen this woman. I don't know why she called me here. And then she just runs her hands across the bar. And she's like, your job is mine now.
Yeah.
Oh my God. And it was her husband she had an affair with from earlier.
I love it. That makes me think of that show Harlots. Have you guys seen Harlots?
I watched it. It's good.
Okay, listen. I love it. There is definitely these two rivalries between these two basically like whorehouse ladies, madams, I guess you want to call them. There's this rivalry and they are devious with each other. And it's so juicy. And it's set like in the late 1800s in London. And it's such a good show. It's such a good show. Yeah, but that's what kind of makes me, when you said that sort of rivalry, I was like, ooh, that's good, because they put like plants in each other's like whorehouses so that a John or something may like try to get them in trouble or, you know, whatever. So there was like a lot of juicy rivalry stuff going on there. But I like that idea. That's a really good idea.
It is, because it's quite scary. You're playing with fire, because what if they don't come and get you out again? Yeah. It's like a proper risk she's taken.
I guess she must have said like, okay, come and get me in 10 days. Because they didn't like have WhatsApp, did they?
that's the other thing too, isn't it? It's like, come and get me in 10 days. But like, what if they come and get her in 2 months? What if, you know, something comes up
Exactly. And what if 10 days is going to be awful, which it sounds like it was going to be. And you suddenly
And women were treated so poorly then that they could have easily just been like, let her stay. We've got men here who are better journalists anyway. Just leave her there. Yeah, she's fine. Yeah. She's having a nice vacation that's a huge risk.
No, absolutely. So, but luckily it went to plan. She gets out and she writes this story up. And when this story breaks, it is an absolute sensation. The readers were shocked and enthralled. So she ended up writing a blockbuster series for the New York World that basically this now shoots her to journalism stardom. She wrote a book of it as well. She goes on to do all sorts. But then, because of this, a grand jury launched an investigation into conditions of the asylum. And they even asked Bly to accompany them on a visit to the premises. So then we have this visit. So question, when Nellie Bly and the investigators arrived, had the asylum been warned of their approach?
Yeah, this feels like an Ofsted...
Yeah.
Like that's the body that investigates schools here. Not investigates, but they sort of rank schools.
Yeah.
The inspectors are coming. So they like sweep up all the dirt and make the kids wash their faces. And they tell like 8 of the kids, like, don't speak.
Yeah. They lock the troublemakers in the cupboard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It feels like, they probably had a heads up.
Okay. Yeah.
I just feel like Nellie was born in the wrong era, because she would have made a killer podcast out of all this, wouldn't she? As well as the book. She would be top of iTunes every single
week. Oh, absolutely.
Oh, she would have sold the rights to this by now.
Oh, for sure.
Again, it sort of goes in their favour, doesn't it? In the sense that if the people in the asylum, if the women in the asylum are saying, yes, this is awful, this is how they treat us, they can just go, oh, no, that's in their minds.
Yeah. Do you agree, Heather?
I do think they were probably warned and made aware of it, because I'm sure they saw the article when it came out in the paper and they probably saw all the hubbub about it, you know? And I think that I just am super distrusting of anybody from previous time periods, because they're just mostly terrible people. Like mostly because women were not treated right. Children were not treated right. Like I just, so I feel like they probably did anything they could to kind of cover the evidence and make it look nice.
Yeah. You guys are all absolutely on the money. Good instincts. Mm. They were absolutely tipped off and they shouldn't have been, but they were definitely prepared for this visit. So this time the boat, even taking them to the island, is clean and new. And then the stories of the nurses and doctors contradicted Nellie's stories, but also they contradicted each other.
Oh, get your story straight, guys. Like, lying 101 is just make sure, like, it can't have been that big a place that.
Yeah.
And also the cover story is, it's actually nice here. It's fine. Like, that's not that hard to follow.
Right, right.
Don't be like, no, I wasn't the one hitting anyone. Oh, I mean, nobody was hitting anyone. Like, yeah, lie better, but no. So everyone avoided responsibility for the condition, saying they didn't know how the treatment, the food, the clothing came to be as Nellie Bly had written about it. And the kitchen suddenly had salt and clean white bread. But most suspiciously, all the women who Bly had quoted and who she had written about as being as sane as her had been discharged or transferred or moved to another quarter where she couldn't see them. So the asylum had taken a lot of steps to cover up its egregious abuse. Mm. So my next question, do the grand jury believe Nelly or the asylum?
I think they believe the asylum because I just feel like in that time period, women were not trusted. Yeah. And if she, unless she had like photographic evidence of it, which it doesn't sound like she had a camera or her cell phone with her. I just think that they probably sided with the asylum because they're like, oh, you know, here's this woman trying to be a journalist, trying to do something. And she's probably just being hysterical and making up stories for attention.
Okay. Yeah. So we've got asylum from Heather. You guys?
Oh, God, yeah. I think asylum as well, unfortunately. I think, and I'm basing that on the fact that I don't think asylums suddenly got any better after 1887. I feel like, you know, if you look at really, like, you know, any asylum in the sort of following 50, 60 years or whatever before they actually, even like Nurse Ratched, like, you know, the Netflix series, like they're doing like ice pick lobotomies. Mm-hmm. Like, it feels like things don't necessarily get much better. So, yeah, I'd love it if Nelly was believed, but I feel, I'm going to have to go with Heather on this one.
Yeah. Okay. Taylor?
So as we know, I have a very patchy memory, especially with history, but I feel like I learned about this case at some point in my life, and I feel like there are some reforms made after all of this. So I'm cautiously optimistic that something, did go in favor of the treatment of the patients, but I could be conflating it with a different story.
So we've got Heather and Hannah saying asylum and Taylor cautiously saying they believe Nelly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Taylor gets it.
Oh, good. Well, I'm pleased to lose there.
Yeah,
that's a good one to lose.
Yeah. So they did. The grand jury believed her, thank goodness. But also, you know, the asylum hadn't done the best job of cover, you know, they'd really tried to cover their tracks, but it was just very suspicious. Everything they'd done was a little bit heavy-handed, and they contradicted each other, and, you know, they'd moved all of those patients and whatever. So the grand jury's report recommended the changes that Bly had proposed and called for a sum of nearly $850,000 to be added to the budget of the Department of Public Charities and Corrections. And the jury also attempted to make future examinations more thorough so that only the seriously ill were admitted to the asylums. Everyone lived happily ever after in Mendicant. Yeah. It's taken really seriously now. Slight glitch with the lobotomies, obviously.
Right.
Yay.
But it obviously wasn't like sweeping reform because, I mean, to Hannah's point, there are still asylums, you know, that are where there's a continuous, you know, mistreatment for many years after that. So there obviously wasn't like sweeping reform to come out of that. But, you know, maybe there was some change that happened, at least made a difference for those women that were there.
Yeah,
you know?
I think this was maybe like the start of small reforms, which led to more reforms, which led to more reforms. But I'm sure that it was very patchy.
I mean, it starts so basic. It's like, okay, maybe the nurses shouldn't be able to punch him in the eye for
some white bread and salt.
Yes.
But that's
only the most nutritious.
And a spider's nest.
They are my two favorite food groups, though. So I'd have been quite happy there, I think. But also, I think the interesting thing here is like, did they get into, I mean, I bet no, but did they get into any trouble for lying and trying to cover this up?
I didn't read about any kind of prosecution, actually. The focus was definitely on improving conditions rather than punishing.
Because I always find it, because it's not even like punishing them for running it badly for so long. It's just that thing of wanting to willfully cover up. Because it just reminds me of our government at the moment. And it's like, oh, this person acted unlawfully. This person acted unlawfully. Are they still in their job and are there zero consequences? Yeah. Yes. And it kind of, I mean, it would shock me if there were any consequences 150 years ago.
But. Yeah. It's
right. Yeah. That's what I was thinking. I was like, dude, the time itself, I highly doubt that they were like, oh, let's, you know, the constable or whoever was running the asylum, the head doctor, whatever, probably had a lot of bribes going on, you know, and a lot of like side deals with people. So he probably got away with it. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a consequence-free environment.
I also read way too many like historical fiction books and watch those types of shows of like just shady, seedy stuff happening 100 years ago. Yeah. And I'm like, trust no one. You can't trust anyone in history.
No, you can't, because there are no laws that could touch them. So just,
no laws.
It's terrifying, really. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I read about this case, and I actually got the idea for it from this article in Jezebel about like the forgotten women reporters who changed the face of journalism. And they were called the stunt girls because, like, obviously the men got called, you know, journalists, but they got called stunt girls because they were doing stunts exposing people.
Of course. Not real journalism, just for show.
It's not journalism when women do it. It wasn't termed investigative, but they really redefined so much stuff. So this Nelly is like kind of the most famous one, but there was a whole bunch of them that like exposed loads of stuff. And there's this book out by Kim Todd, Sensational, The Hidden History of America's Stunt Girl Reporters, which did sound really interesting.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. I'd love to know like more about also like what women had to do to actually get attention as journalists in those days. And they, again, it's that thing of having to just be 10 times better to be, you know, to be noticed.
Yeah.
Be more creative, more think, like you said earlier, think outside the box. I think it was like the most perfect crime for me, since I am a journalist and I've been doing this for such a long time. I wish I was that creative and that bold. I think I was when I was younger, but definitely not now. Now I'm like, oh, how far do I have to drive for this story? Am I going to be on the freeway for a long time? Okay. I'm going to pass.
Yeah, you got to weigh it up.
Do I have to put makeup on to go cover this story? Okay. It's late. I've definitely like lost my edge a little bit.
That's good though.
Drunk women solving crime.
So this is a listener crime that was sent. I mean, it came into our inbox like, I swear it was like 3 a.m., which I really love, but I assume this person is in a different country and isn't having 3 a.m. sandwiches. But it says, fellow drunk women, I was having a quick bite at a deli for lunch around the corner from work. I stepped away from my sandwich to use the restroom. I covered my sandwich with a napkin just in case, but when I got back, my sandwich was gone. It couldn't have been gone for more than 3 minutes, and nobody was seen taking it by the other patrons. My table was closer to the store window than the sidewalk. So it just doesn't make sense. She didn't even put a name at the end there. She ended email with, it just doesn't make sense.
Did the waiter come and clean up?
Yeah, that's a good shout.
That's my initial, that would be my initial thing, and be like, oh man, they must have thought I was done because you put a napkin over it. That signals, at least in my mind, that you're done with the plate. I don't know if that's
ever been. That's very true. Good point.
She pretty much did the universal thing for I'm finished with my food.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
We used to like, is this a universal thing that if you put your knife and fork down in the middle of the plate, that meant you were finished? Or is that just?
Yeah, if they were together.
Yeah. If you put them
together. Yeah. Or a napkin.
There are apparently like official, if you cross your cutlery, then you're midway through the meal and they're not supposed to take it. I don't think anyone still follows this. And then if they're straight, you're finished. But there's like symbols.
I hate having to do that thing in a bar where I've got like the tiniest bit of wine left and a waiter comes to collect it and I go, no!
Like, yeah, you're like, no, I'm gonna drink that. Yes, well, it's so expensive. Like, I don't know how much it is there, but it's so expensive here. Like in LA, you go out and it's like $15 for a 4 ounce glass of wine at some places, and I'm like, I'm literally gonna drink every drop of this if I'm spending $15. But yeah, so maybe she just put her napkin over and someone was like, oh, she's done.
Okay, so this,
I gotta say, I think we solved it.
Well, what I like about this, and actually I've got a name now, it's Jess. And what I like about Jess's email is that she emailed 10 minutes later to say, hi again, I'm the one with the case of the missing sandwich. I forgot to mention that the plate was still on the table. A server didn't just remove the plate, and I was astounded by missing plate. Wait, she said it wasn't. Okay, just letting you know.
So was the plate still there? Just the sandwich was gone.
The sandwich was gone.
Was there a dog in there? Ooh. I'm going to blame a canine.
And a dog. Oh, do you know what? I'm going to blame It sounds, do you remember, Taylor, you once told us that you used to, when you were a student, you used to dare each other to go into restaurants and steal food.
Yes. And you know what? I was going to bring that up, but I'm like, don't tell that again. But here we are.
But it was
a young, misunderstood, creative, wonderful college student gal who just couldn't say no to a dare.
Yeah.
I would have done that, like, for no money. Just like, I dare you to go eat that person's sandwich. Like, just to show that I'm brave, I would have done it at a certain.
The dog theory would make more sense, especially now in the time of COVID. Yeah. I can't imagine eating someone's sandwich right now. You know what I mean? That's a very good point. We are in a pandemic, unless somebody is still just like, you know, I'm vaccinated. Woo! I'm going to eat random food. You know,
I can't imagine. It's a vaccine denier or somebody who's very proud of their two vaccines and really wanted to do a dare.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a fucking boomer, isn't it? That's who it is. It's somebody over 60 who owns their own house and thinks, oh, there's a sandwich. It's mine. I deserve everything.
I'm going to take it.
I think the thing I would say to Jess is just thank God it wasn't a laptop. Because that's the thing that people leave on tables sometimes to go for a wee. And I just think, you're crazy, man. I would no.
I would never.
Yeah. I don't know. I've had some sandwiches where I'd be just as upset. And some shitty laptops.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I feel like it's solved.
Yeah. That's how
we got to the bottom of it. And that's what matters.
Ooh. Well, now it just remains for us to hear more about Heather. What are you up to? Where can we find you?
Yay. Well, I would absolutely love it if everybody would check out my podcast. Yeah. It's called Motherhood in Hollywood. I've done almost 250 episodes where I've interviewed celebrities, influencers in Hollywood, directors, producers, writers about their experience as parents in the movie industry in Hollywood. And then people can also follow my adventures as an actor and reporter and mom on my Instagram and TikTok and Facebook, The Heather Brooker, if you want to follow me over there. And then you can also check out motherhoodinhollywood.com. And that's where I sometimes post, you know, write things about what I'm doing. And that's where I share my podcast as well. So I would love that. Yeah, I would love that.
That sounds so good. So what in Motherhood in Hollywood, what kinds of stuff comes up in the podcasts?
Well, I mean, it depends on the person I'm talking to and their individual story. Like I recently interviewed a mother-daughter duo who the mom is an actor and her daughter got into acting several years ago and her daughter surpassed her mom in terms of like celebrity and bookings and work. Her daughter is actually starring in some huge movies that are going to be coming out. And so it was really interesting to hear their perspective. They also don't live in Hollywood. They live in North Carolina where they lead a very normal life. It's just her daughter happens to be a big movie star, you know? So like, to me, that's a really interesting story. And then I will interview someone like, you know, a Sherry Shepherd or Elizabeth Shue who have been in the business for a very long time. And so it just depends, you know, it kind of like what happens with you guys, what comes up organically and whatever conversations you have. I'm curious to hear people's stories and how they're balancing or juggling their family life while pursuing their dreams in this industry, because it's not a normal 9-to-5 job for a parent where you can go in, talk to your other parents, go, hey, how are you handling sleep issues? And what are you doing with nursing struggles? Or, hey, what school issues are you having? There's not that sort of community, especially if you're not on a series regular or a show or movie regularly. So we talk about that and I sort of try to glean whatever I can from these wonderful stories and find things that I can apply in my own life and my own world. And then I share it with my community as well. So it's been a really wonderful experience and I love it.
That sounds awesome. I love it. This is everything I need to know, balancing. Wicked. Thank you so much for joining us. You've been such a fantastic guest. Give it up for Heather Brooker.
Thank you, thank you guys. This was so much fun.
Drunk Women Solving Crime is produced by Amanda Redman. Music by The Lion and the Wolf. If you would like to, you can follow us on Drunk Women Pod on Twitter. On Facebook and Insta, we are Drunk Women Solving Crime. And please review us on Apple Podcasts. And also, if you have a crime that you would like us to solve, write it on a review on Apple Podcasts as well. Thank you to Acas and thank you for listening. Bye!
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.